Laudator Jesus Christus. Praise be Jesus Christ. Welcome, friends, to another episode of Council of Faith, where we are looking at the post-conciliar documents of Vatican II. Today we're going to look at two documents. The first one is entitled Sterilization in Catholic Hospitals, and this was written in 1975. One of the concerns of the Church immediately following Vatican II was that in many of our Catholic hospitals around the world, particularly in the United States, there was this great controversy that was starting to arise with the emergence of, after Roe v. Wade, of abortion on demand, with the proliferation of artificial contraception. We now have Catholic hospitals encountering the problem of people coming to them, asking them for these types of procedures. One thing in particular would be the sterilization, whether it's vasectomy or tubal ligation. Of course, a Catholic hospital, it would stand to reason, would be against having any type of abortion. But what about these sterilizations? So this document addresses that particular concern, and this is from the Sacred Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith, the one that's currently headed by Cardinal Ratzinger. The document tells us in paragraph 1, any sterilization whose sole immediate effect of itself, that is of its own nature and condition, is to render the generative faculty incapable of procreation, is to be regarded as a direct sterilization, and is this understood, therefore, in statements of the Pontifical Magisterium, especially of Pope Pius XII. It is absolutely forbidden, therefore, according to the teachings of the Church, that even when motivated by subjectively right intention of curing or preventing a physical or psychological ill effect which is foreseen or feared as a result of pregnancy. The sterilization of the faculty itself is even more strongly prohibited than is the sterilization of individual acts, since it's nearly always irreversible. What the document is saying here is this. When people are employing artificial contraception, that concerns an individual act of intimacy between the husband and the wife. And obviously that can be stopped at any time. When we're talking about sterilization, however, in a vasectomy or tubal ligation, that's a permanent action. And in most cases, it is irreversible. Even in terms of the tubal ligation, there's no guarantee that if the woman goes and has that reversed, that she'll be able then to have children afterwards. Even more so in the case of the man who has the vasectomy. And so because this is a very permanent decision, it's even more serious than when we're talking about artificial contraception. And again, the Church's main focus on this concerns the whole purpose of sexual intimacy between husband and wife. It's a twofold mystery and beauty of life that focuses on unity and procreation, on love and on life. And those two aspects must always be connected in any sexual act between the husband and the wife. When you separate love and life, then you're dividing what God has meant to be together. Just like in marriage, the man and the woman come together as husband and wife, and Jesus says the two become one flesh, so too in sexual intimacy, it is the perfect expression of unity between husband and wife, but also the openness to potential life is another sign of that love, because my love for you, your love for me is so intense, so complete, we're open to the possibility of maybe that love now taking expression in another person. It doesn't mean that every single act of sexual intimacy must result in the birth or conception of a child. Obviously, this is why couples are allowed to use the natural family planning means of spacing their births and regulating how many children they hope to have. But using artificial means of contraception, as we would see in Humani Vitae, is opposed, and so is sterilization opposed, because now what you're doing is dividing those two purposes, love and life, unity and procreation. In paragraph 2, the congregation reaffirms this traditional Catholic teaching. It is aware that many theologians dissent from it, but it denies that this fact has any doctrinal significance. In other words, just because there are theologians who dissent from a moral or doctrinal teaching does not carry weight in and of itself. even if 99% of all the world's theologians disagreed with the teaching of the church, that would not mean that the doctrine has to be changed. Just look in church history. When the majority of bishops and theologians at one time were actually Arian, the heresy of Arianism talked about Jesus as being subservient to God, not being equal to God. And there were many bishops and theologians who fell into Arianism. In fact, one of the great church saints said that one moment the church woke up and groaned to find out that most of the world was Arian. It was a faithful remnant which remained loyal to the Orthodox Catholic faith that did not believe in Arianism. So the majority does not rule in this case, because it's not public opinion which determines truth. Truth is something that resides within the thing itself. If something is objectively, intrinsically good or objectively, intrinsically evil is determined by the thing itself. It's determined by divine law or by the natural law, but not by public opinion. It's not voted upon. You can't put it to a plebiscite. Paragraph 3, with regard to the administration of Catholic hospitals, the following is absolutely forbidden. Cooperation, officially approved or admitted, in actions which of themselves have a contraceptive purpose. The impeding of natural effects for the deliberate sexual acts of the person sterilized. For the official approval of direct sterilization, and all the more so, its administration and execution according to the hospital regulations is something of its nature that is intrinsically or objectively evil. Nothing can justify a Catholic hospital in cooperating in it. B. The traditional teaching on material cooperation, with its appropriate distinctions between necessary, freely given cooperation, proximate, and remote cooperation, remains valid, to be applied very prudently when the case demands it. So for instance, we know from the natural moral law, just from basic ethics, you can never do a wrong, no matter what your intention. The ends does not justify the means. Two wrongs don't make a right, something we learned when we were little children. Well, it's a fundamental principle. I can never do any evil, no matter what my intention, no matter what my motives. We can never intentionally do an evil act, no matter what good may come from it. We may tolerate an evil, if we employ the principle of double effect. If an evil is being done, we may tolerate it. But I myself cannot choose to commit an evil or to cooperate in an evil. For instance, if somebody says, well, I'm going to murder this one person, and if you don't help me, I'm going to blow up this school bus. I cannot cooperate in that evil. Even though a good would be done, that we are saving the lives of many more people, I cannot commit an evil act, kill one person to save a group of others. Evil can be tolerated. If I can't stop that person from doing what they're going to do, I didn't cooperate in it. If there was no way of me stopping them physically, if there was no way of me contacting the police, at least morally speaking, I did not cooperate in an evil act. But if I were to participate and help in the murder of that innocent person, that guilt is upon my soul, and it's not negated by the fact that some good happened to spin off from it. So too, the church wants to remind the Catholic hospitals, no matter all the good that's being done in those hospitals, all the lives that are saved, all the diseases that are cured, will not negate even one act that is intrinsically evil. And so if we believe that abortion is evil, we believe that sterilization, artificial contraception, are against the moral law, then a Catholic hospital cannot condone that, cannot promote that. If people want to have those things done and they do not agree with the church's teaching, they'll have to go elsewhere. Catholic hospital is not in the position to evangelize and catechize in the same way that a church is or a priest can, so they perhaps will not go to the individual patients and try to persuade them or win them over, but they can absolutely say, we refuse to do these procedures. They go against our moral code of ethics. The third part of paragraph 3, when applying the principle of material cooperation, as the case warrants it, scandal and the danger of creating misunderstanding must be carefully avoided with the help of suitable explanation of what's going on. We have to recall that sometimes in a hospital, for instance, There are things which are necessary. There are things which are optional. If someone's going to have a procedure done, they're going to need to have anesthesia. They're going to need to have someone watch the blood pressure. They're going to need someone to administer pain medication. If a nurse is in the hospital and her job is to take care of the patients, as long as that nurse is not directly involved in the immoral, evil act itself, she can still cooperate in a necessary fashion. For instance, if a person who has just had or is about to have a tubal ligation or vasectomy, that nurse who's working there, he or she does not have the choice to pick which patients they're going to work with. They can still give medicine in terms of pain medication. They can take blood pressure. They can take the person's temperature. They can do all the normal, typical procedures. What they cannot participate is in the act itself, to cooperate, assist the doctor in doing any procedure which we would regard as immoral, which would not only apply to sterilization, but also to abortion. If a nurse works in a non-Catholic hospital, for instance, and is asked to assist in the abortion, that nurse must refuse, morally speaking. If they don't, they're no better than those people who assisted the Nazis at the death camps in World War II. But if someone is in a position where this is their job and they need this job, they can say to the hospital, I will not do certain things, but I will do typical, normal, morally acceptable things. For instance, giving a pain pill, taking the blood pressure or temperature, as I mentioned before. The document concludes by telling us that this congregation hopes the criteria outlined will meet the expectations of all the episcopate. They want the bishops, who they are the ones who know, because these hospitals are in their dioceses, to very passionately approach the administrators. Let them know that as a Catholic hospital, they have a responsibility in two ways. One is to save lives, to enhance the quality of life, and two, to be a Christian witness. That's the whole purpose of being a Catholic hospital. That document was particularly short, but it was very succinct and had to deal with an important issue. The next document I want us to look at is the Declaration on Certain Problems of Sexual Ethics. This was written in 1975. And again, imagine what was going on in 1975. We're again in the midst of the so-called sexual revolution. We've got people who are experimenting with drugs. We've got children and parents at each other's throats. There's civil disharmony. The church is concerned, particularly because of the fact that in the 1970s, we see an enormous rise in illicit sexual intimacy among adults, children, even people older than that. In paragraph 1, morals are becoming increasingly corrupt. One of the most ominous signs of this is unrestrained glorification of sex. In the 70s, sex became a right, almost an innate right in many people's minds. That I have a right to have sex whenever I want, with whomever I want, however I want. Before that, at least people who were unfaithful, those who did commit fornication or adultery, at least they would admit publicly, at least objectively they would say they knew they were doing wrong, even though they may not have been willing to stop it. But now, for the first time publicly, we've got people who are saying, I have a right to do this. You have no right to tell me no. What two consenting adults do should be no one's business, started to be coined in the 1970s. They were divorcing the act of sexual intimacy from marriage. And there's where the problem comes in, because the teaching of the church has been consistent for 2,000 years. Sex is a holy thing. It's not a dirty word. It isn't something that we should whisper behind closed doors, sex. But it's a holy thing when done properly, when it's done between a husband and wife, and when it's done for the two purposes God created it, for unity, love, and for openness to life, procreation. Those two things are always intimately connected. When a husband and wife use sex to show their love for each other, and it becomes something that unites them, sometimes what happens is, if one of the husband or the wife only seek their own personal pleasure, they see the other as a tool, a means to that. then that person ceases to be a person. Their spouse now just becomes a means of my personal gratification. Well, then that is going against what God had intended. God intended sexual intimacy for marriage so that a husband and wife can become closer together, not just physically, obviously, but spiritually and emotionally. How can that happen? We know how the physical mechanics work, but spiritually and emotionally, how can sex bring husband and wife together? Because I'm giving of myself. It's not so much what am I going to receive, but I'm giving of myself. I'm trying to please my spouse more than trying to seek my pleasure. If I receive pleasure, that is sort of a fruit of the labor, but my primary intention is to please the other, to show my love, my affection, my tenderness to the other, to show that we are a couple. If that's my primary purpose, instead of getting all hung up on what's going to please me, then that's going to not only alleviate a lot of stress on married couples, but also give them the proper perspective. And this idea that they are open to the possibility of new life. So the doctrine continues. The church cannot remain indifferent to the confusion of minds and the corruption of morals. False opinions and moral and the immoral conduct to which they lead have continued to spread throughout the world. Consequently, the Sacred Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith judged it necessary to publish this declaration in view of its function in the Universal Church and at the request of the Supreme Roman Pontiff. It was not only the condition of the world, but it was also the Holy Father who said to the congregation, please, we need to address this issue. We have this was the age of so-called free love, you know, Woodstock and afterwards, that everybody wanted to have sex. It didn't matter if you were married or not. And at that point, it didn't matter which gender, didn't matter what the age was. Why? Because sex was seen as something in and of itself, separate. Well, it's not separate. It's always intimately, morally connected to marriage. And even within marriage, it's always intimately connected to those two principles of love and life, unity and procreation. And when we divide what God has united, it's like splitting of the atom. What happens when you split the atom? There's a great amount of tremendous energy released, but it's destructive. And that's how the atomic bomb was created. So too, when we divide what God has united, it has destructive potential. And we see this now in the erosion of the family. We see this in the high divorce rate. We see this in the spread of all types of venereal diseases because of this division of what God had intended to be one. We're told man's true dignity cannot be achieved unless the essential order of his nature be observed. We must act according to our nature. St. Thomas Aquinas said in his Summa Theologica, agere sequitur esse. Things act according to their nature. It's in the nature of birds that they fly, nature of fish that they swim. Animals have intercourse because of instinct. All right, they're driven within their bodies by instinct to replicate and keep the species going. Man, however, has reason and a free will. And we of all the animals, because we are made in the image and likeness of God and they are not, we choose whom we're going to have sex with, and we choose why we're going to have sex. And because we have the use of choice, of free will, and it engages the intellect, it now becomes a moral act. Animals cannot commit a moral act, either immorally evil or morally good. Only a human being can do that. So every act of sex between a human being is either morally good or morally bad. It's always a human act. It involves an act of the will. The document goes on, it is wrong to assert, as many do today, that neither human nature nor revealed law provide any absolute unchangeable norms as a guide for individual actions. People say, well, those are the old days. There's no black and white. Why is it that not only the Ten Commandments tell us not to commit adultery, why is it that the Bible is so explicit against fornication, against all acts of illicit sexual union? And this is not just contained in the Judeo-Christian scriptures. We find this in almost every other culture. every other society, Egyptians, we have Romans, the Greeks, at least in their heyday when they were striving to be morally good people, there were laws or at least social mores against these things. You look at the Romans. We all think of their decadent days towards the end when they were having all kinds of wild orgies. We think of the Emperor Caligula. That is the deterioration stage of the Roman Empire. Look at its early stage. Look at the time of the Emperor Caesar Augustus. He wanted people to be married, and there was this Roman ideal of building up of the family, that it was considered bad taste, bad manners, and even to be unpatriotic to go outside the marriage bed, because you were destroying the family. The family was the very heart of the Roman Empire. That's why when the immorality crept in and the Roman family was destroyed, the empire fell apart. We're told since sexual ethics have to do with certain fundamental values of human and Christian life, this general teaching applies equally to sexual ethics. Anything you and I do as human beings that engages the will and the intellect becomes a moral act. Therefore, it involves ethics. This deals with things I do, whether it's sexual intimacy between husband and wife, deals with issues of life, whether it's abortion or euthanasia. There's a broad spectrum of topics that morality covers. Ethics covers the actions of men and women when it involves their free will. Whether we're talking about nuclear war, whether we're talking about capital punishment, the economy, anything that I have a direct voice in, I can choose to do this or not to do that. One of the greatest problems we've seen in recent times has been this increase in couples living together. We see in paragraph 7, nowadays many claim the right of sexual intercourse before marriage, at least for those who have a firm intention of marrying, and whose love for one another, already conjugal as it were, is deemed to demand this as a natural outcome. This opinion is contrary to church teaching, the document tells us. Sad to say, 3 out of 4 weddings in church, in the Catholic Church, 3 out of 4, the couples are living together prior to marriage. If they're not living together, they're at least sexually active together. 1 out of 4 are not living together and are trying to be abstinent, trying to be chaste. 3 out of 4. And I, as a priest, when I interview many of these couples, when I was newly ordained, back in 1988, some of them tried to fudge and give you pretend addresses. When you say, where do you live? One would give you one address, one would give you another one. But sometimes the one didn't really sound like it was real. They didn't know where they really lived. You later found out they actually were living together. Now when you ask them, they both very calmly, casually give you the same address. And you say, are you living? Oh, yes, Father. Do you know it's wrong? No, there's nothing wrong with that. We love each other. Yes, you love each other. If you love each other, you're going to do what's right. If you love each other, you want to do what's best for the other. If my spouse or my intended spouse is diabetic, do I keep giving her candy? I would hope not, unless it's dietetic candy. But if she has a problem, or let's say my spouse is lactose intolerant and is allergic to milk and dairy products, I wouldn't start giving them all kinds of cheeses. I would show respect for their body and not giving something that was bad for them. In the same way, spiritually, you want to give someone what's good for them. You want them to do what's good for them. If you are in love with someone and you're not yet married, and what if that your fiancé all of a sudden comes home and you notice they got their shoe off and their toes are turning all kinds of colors, all right, and it's not because they painted them. You say, honey, you better go see a doctor. If you didn't show that concern for their foot, they're going to say, some boyfriend I got doesn't care. My foot's going to be amputated, all right? Doesn't show any concern for my body. Why should they show any concern for my soul? Well, if you show no concern for their soul, how could you have concern for their body? The two are connected. Premarital sex, all right, is immoral, just as extramarital sex is immoral. Even though everybody claims to be doing it, even though every movie glorifies it. One of the most pathetic things I've witnessed, I took some altar boys to the movies so many years ago. We went to see the movie Batman. I read the comic book, saw the TV series growing up. I figured this would be nice, take the kids to see innocuous movie. What do we see happening in the middle of the movie? It has nothing to do with the plot. Batman has to take this girl to bed. It was never in the comic book. You never saw it on the TV series. What did it have to do with the movie? Nothing. But what did it teach the young people? Well, if superheroes do it, if people on TV do it, if it's done by everyone at school, it must be okay. What about what the Bible says? What about what the natural law says? This document is concerned about the idea that our sexual ethics are not determined by the press, is not determined by the media. Our sexual ethics must be based on two things. The natural law, which everybody with the aid of reason can ascertain, and from divine revelation, primarily through the sacred scriptures. Those two aspects, natural law and divine revelation, tell us what's morally right or morally wrong. Sex is a sacred thing when done properly, when done in the context of married life. Marriage is one of the greatest blessings God has given the human race. Please respect marriage and all that's involved in it. Thank you for your kind attention. We ask you to please tune in again for another episode. May God bless you and Mary keep you.